The open public input, we have a few folks that have joined us. I will call you up two at a time, and I think most of you know the rules of engagement. 3 minutes, you'll hear a beep, and that signifies, you know, you can finish your thought, bring it to a conclusion. So with that, Patty Carter and Bruce Vandervoort, please.
Good morning, commissioners and deputy director. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. We've come, Georgia Prosek, our president of Puyallup Historical Hatchery Foundation, and myself, Patty Carter. We were founding directors of the Puyallup Historical Hatchery Foundation, and we'd like to come and give you an update every year, just to let you know we're very busy, and lots more volunteers are helping us, and things are moving along. So I think you're given a picture report, and with that, I'd like to make a few comments. As I prepared for this visit, I thought, what is Fish and Wildlife's mission and vision? And how do we fit in? How do we help? In part, your mission statement, your vision statement, it says to preserve, protect, and perpetuate fish along with the ecosystems in which they live. Well, I can see no greater purpose for our involvement towards the fulfillment of your mission than that of bringing young children and students to the Puyallup Hatchery, with a goal of teaching them, showing them, demonstrating to them how we care for our precious watershed, along with the fun of experiencing trout and salmon in all phases of their development. In 2012, the Puyallup Hatchery was saved for a reason. As the Puyallup Historical Hatchery Foundation enters just the third year of our five-year MOU with Fish and Wildlife, we'd like to report we've had two very successful annual salmon homecomings with about 1,000 folks this last October. And we continue with weekly educational tours for all groups and people of all ages. In fact, there's another one going on today at 10 o'clock with 27 little preschool students from Federal Way. Our big announcement, however, this year, which I think you'll be delighted to hear about, is, and I must say, I think it's with God's intervention, because all along the way he's helped us accomplish amazing things in a very short time. And we worked with the Puyallup School District, which is going to be bringing every single fourth grade student starting next school year to that hatchery for their STEM education, science education. That's about 2,000 children, and it will be an ongoing thing. The program is being developed right now and through the rest of this year. We're working with Dr. Christine Maloney. I put a picture of the two gals on that thing to show you who they are. Dr. Christine Maloney, wonderful lady. She's the district-wide curriculum director for Puyallup. And Stephanie Hagel, she was Science Educator of the Year this year in Washington State. So an amazing woman to have working that we're with. And we also have some other organizations, educators, that will be helping develop this curriculum that fits nicely in with what the state intends for children to learn. Some of those are salmon life cycle, of course, habitat and the ecosystem, metamorphosis and migration, threats to the species, and human impacts. That one, to me, is very important. New signs are going to be going up all throughout the hatchery grounds that will be at the fourth grade level, which should be helpful to anybody visiting as well. We have a lot of visitors. So I ask, who will perpetuate the preservation and protection of our watersheds, our ecosystems in which they live, if not the next generation we teach? And it's a gift to have that 80 acres, the establishment of the school partnership with the upgrades, which we're very happy about. The money that's been budgeted to upgrade that hatchery is money well invested. Thank you again for allowing us, this little group of people, to have the opportunity to help make this happen.
Well, thank you, Patty. Thank you for your leadership. That's an outstanding
question.
Yep. Go ahead, David.
Patty, are you familiar with Salmon Fest over in Leavenworth?
Yes, I've never participated in that, but I've been to the hatchery. My daughter's been to the hatchery. She's on our foundation board as well. Every hatchery we can get to, we take photos and information, and we're trying to incorporate bringing that to Puyallup's.
They, for 25 years, have provided a day for third grade children to come to the hatchery. They have developed a curriculum that's been vetted by the state to meet all of the requirements for their science curriculum. And I would encourage you to talk to them because they have already done this work and have been doing it for 25 years. They had their 25th annual celebration. It's a very sophisticated program and curriculum, and they host 2,500 students every year. It sounds like it mirrors exactly what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. They've done the work, and they've upgraded it over time to keep it current with state standards. And if you'd like, I could give you some contact information.
I would love that.
It might save you a lot of time
and
effort.
Yes, I would love that, and I'll forward that to Stephanie. Stephanie was able to create the curriculum at the sixth grade level for the Puyallup schools, and they used WSU as the out-of-the-classroom kind of, you know, taking kids there. So to have Dr. Maloney just, as soon as she saw it and walked up to the creek, and she says, oh, my gosh, you know, this is, I mean, we have, in the middle of town, you have fern growing out of the old growth. I mean, it's an incredible place, and I'm glad that, you know, the state still owns it and we can utilize it. I would love to have that forwarded to me, and because we're all in the process of just now building that so that it works well with the standards that are required for STEM education.
Yes, the work has been done.
Yeah,
so
that's great.
Very easy for you to take
great.
That and use it.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Or whatever, so we can get a
thank you. And you're all invited to our next salmon homecoming. We'll try to have smoked salmon for some people. Thanks.
Patty, great report. Is this facility open to children, other school districts outside of Puyallup, or is it limited to?
Yes. Well, the educational center is pretty small. We got half the duplex that the state owns, and we've converted that, and it's beautiful inside, and it's very usable, but for small groups. When we do tours, we usually split groups so that they have the nursery. We call it the nursery. I do anyway. The nursery going on, the educational center with some movies, and up to the stream and the walks and the trails. So it's a very diverse place for teaching. What were you asking me again? I'm sorry.
Well, I just think that I was wondering if it's inclusive of people outside of the Puyallup area.
Yes. In fact, the state gave us, we have a huge, enormous, it's about the size of that screen there, historic hatchery, next exit. And it's right on the freeway. And we were able to get that in last year. So we've had a lot of people that even stay at the hotels. And we work with the Puyallup Chamber, Puyallup Sumner Chamber of Commerce. We're on their list. We're on the city's list. It's a place to visit. So the outdoor signage, as we grow that, there's a few right now, to help people just self-guided tours. That's kind of a goal to do, too. And I will tell you, Jim Jenkins has been wonderful to work with. He's our little go-to guy there. And he's, like, happy, and he comes to our salmon home. He says, do whatever you need. And I says, well, we could move signs if you get ready to, you know, do the infrastructure and things, because I know there's a lot of upgrades needed at that hatchery.
Good work. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you again, Patty. Martha? Bruce?
Morning, Commissioners. I'm the president of the Washington State Trappers Association. There seems to be a growing interest in trapping in the state, and I'd just like to tell you that our membership has grown about 8% just since June, when I spoke with you last, and I expect our membership to top 800 members before the end of the year. Today, though, I would like to address proposed changes to the wildlife interaction rules that is on your agenda this morning. I know this is a bit late in the game for comments. I have had a number of productive meetings with Stephanie Simic and Mick Cope, and have come to an understanding on most of the rule changes. There is one item, however, we have not been able to agree on, and it is important enough I feel compelled to raise an objection. That item is found in WAC 232.12.142. The rule is being changed to read, raw fur may only be retained for personal use or education purposes which do not result in retail sale or commerce. Also, the definition of raw fur, which is the same as the definition of raw fur in RCW 77 15-192 has been deleted. That is a departure from current rule. RCW 77.15-194 states, it is unlawful to knowingly buy, sell, barter, or otherwise exchange, or offer to buy, sell, barter, or otherwise exchange the raw fur of a mammal or mammal that has been trapped in this state with a steel-jawed leg hold trap or any other body-gripping trap, whether or not pursuant to permit. Furthermore, RCW 77.15.192 defines raw fur. Raw fur means a pelt that has not been processed for purposes of retail sale. The law clearly allows the sale of fur caught legally in body-gripping traps to be sold if processed for retail sale. This law came about as a result of passage of Initiative 713. The language was quite clear, and we tend to think the people voted for the law as the initiative was written. Why then is the department trying to make the law more restrictive? These animals are being killed because they are causing some kind of a problem, not for commerce. So we are talking about a small percentage of fur trapped in the state. However, the Washington State Trappers Association feels very strongly that is wrong to unnecessarily waste these fur bearers. Washington State has some of the most restrictive laws on trapping in the nation. Why do we need to further restrict trapping? We ask that WAC 232.12.142 remain unchanged with respect to the sale of fur so that it may reflect current RCWs.
Thank you, Bruce. Any questions from commissioners? Comments? Yes.
This has been a subject to debate this morning of this change in process. Nate, could you speak to this, why it was done? No, I didn't see Mick back. I'm sorry.
My name is Mick Cope. I'm a game division manager with the department. As Bruce had mentioned, we've worked through many of these rules, including this one, and had discussions about this issue over the last several months. The proposal, as it's written, is intended. It has a modification in there to allow for educational purposes and personal use. The intent of that change is to limit the kind of commercialization of furs that are caught under this specially authorized permit. Comes out of the legislature that says the department can authorize these special traps, and we want to make sure that the intent of no commerce associated with body gripping traps is withheld even within the special permit trap authorized through the department.
I'm not sure what to do with this difference of viewpoints because it sounds like the gentleman is trying to bring it to our attention that the way the WAC is written is not consistent with the RCW. So do you have a response to that directly?
In our discussions, and I'm probably not saying anything that I haven't said with Bruce in person, the discussion has been that, you know, the intent of that the law is that body gripping traps in commerce were the key pieces. We have a special authorization from the law that says the agency can make special permits available to trap using body gripping traps. We were just trying to keep the commerce associated with that down.
I guess the capitalist in me is getting the best of me. If we have a problem animal, we could tell these guys, go trap it, take care of it, and they would take the pelt and be happy. Or we're going to have to pay somebody to go do it?
it's probably addressed in both ways. It doesn't, sometimes it, animals are removed not necessarily for for a fee. Sometimes trappers will trap them under their own trapping license, but with a special permit. Then it's just the special permit part that becomes, I mean, we worked together originally. The original proposal said that there would be no use whatsoever, and through discussion realized there's great opportunities for education and personal use of those items, that people tend to hold on to them and use them for their own use. It's just the commercialization part, and I'll let Bruce speak to the to that if you'd like.
We appreciated you know, our discussions with Mick, and he did take into consideration the personal use and educational purposes, and you know, we really appreciate that. But our reading of the law is that it specifically allows the sale of raw of fur after it has been processed for retail sale, and we'd like to keep it that way. If somebody, say I go and catch an animal on one of these permits, and I send it off and have it tanned, then it's been processed for retail sale, I should be able to sell that. And that's the way the law has been interpreted for 15 years. And now all of a sudden we're deciding that no, you can't do that. And you know, we don't understand the what problem has been created that the law needs to be changed.
I understand this too, so it seems like we're going back to the original intent of the original law that was passed, which banned leg hold traps for sale. You cannot sell that fur regardless. Yet an exception was made to allow leg hold traps in the case of damage or whatever. So I think that's really the key of the argument is right there, if I'm correct, is but your point I'm trying to understand is, up until this time, if a trapper was allowed to or called in to trap a problem animal, could it go to the for commercial use up till this time?
Bruce, maybe you can weigh in.
You know, the law doesn't say the sale of fur. It says the sale of raw fur. And the law, it defines raw fur. It means a pelt that has not been processed for purposes of retail sale. So we cannot take one of these furs from one of these animals and sell that raw fur, which, you know, that's where most of our fur is sold into the commercial markets. It's sold as raw fur. You know, there are a very few animals that are trapped on these permits in comparison to the number that are trapped in the regular trapping season with cage traps now. But those few animals, we have been able to send that fur off and get it processed and sell that retail, because the law specifically allows retail sale right now. And again, we don't understand why the law needs to be changed.
I think what I'm hearing is, to clear up any confusion in the larger public's eye about, are you going back on a bill that was passed that said no commercial use of leg hold trapped animals for whatever reason. So that's a...
Yeah, and that's been the discussion that we've had at a variety of different times over the last several months. Thank you, Bruce.
Kent and Martha.
Hi, I'm Martha Jordan, and for a long time, all of you have known me to represent the Trumpeter Swan Society and the Washington Swan Stewards. This last winter, I did leave that organization after a long association due to changes in that organization, but also in terms of the conservation needs and the needs of swans here in the state of Washington. We had a die-off last winter that was extremely unexpected in South King County between Falls City and Carnation. We lost more than 50 swans due to lead shot ingestion. At this time, we don't know exactly where that lead came from, but the speculation at this point is it wasn't hunting lead, more likely clay targets and dog training lead. So we have a new concern here. But we have a new organization. It's called the Northwest Swan Conservation Association, and we're going just the same as we always were. We've just changed ourselves to a local tax-exempt nonprofit, and the support from not only the agency but from the whole public, not only just in Washington but the whole region, has been absolutely phenomenal. So we're not only doing what we were doing, we're able to do a whole lot more. And that's the really good news, is we're doing a lot of collaboration on things like power line collisions, the lead issue, and the Johnson to Bay Swan Reserve. We can do more with that. We can do more with public education and outreach to schools, wildlife rehab, and we're working now with Alaska wildlife rehabbers and getting some regional rehab stuff going that we didn't have the ability to help with before, because we don't do rehab. We just kind of do a lot of other things. So we're still doing surveys. We're also going to participate in the five-year survey, which means the department pays for the plane and I donate my time to do the Outer Coast and Hood Canal. And we'll still do the aerial surveys. And the Washington Waterfowl Association gave us $1,500 to do three aerial surveys in the whole Snohomish, King County, and North Pierce County area for this year to monitor whether or not we're going to have another die-off. Since we've had flooding already, we have some serious concerns that we're going to see another die-off. And so we've got monitors in the field, and we're working in collaboration with the agency. So we're moving forward on that, and we're really happy doing citizen science. And it brings us back to the lead issue. As you know, California's banned lead ammunition for the most part. Oregon is making some real progress and strides, and in fact, Friday and Saturday, is a conference on lead ammunition and hunting in the state of Oregon, and it's put on by the Oregon Wildlife Society chapter, which we're really excited about, and we are going to go to that. So we're working on that, and we would like to see more done here in the state of Washington, such as target shooting on wildlife areas, because lead is, in fact, being picked up by songbirds and other birds that you just don't see the mortality, because what we found in the die-off this last year for the first time was the number of Canada goose carcasses that we were seeing and some duck carcasses, but mostly if the ducks get sick, the raptors pick them up like that. And the predation on even swans, because we were out there even two times a day in areas, and there would be predation happening. So encourage you to do more in that zone. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Martha. Questions from the commission? Well, yes.
I remember you coming before us and giving us testimony about the die-off, the surprising die-off last year. Can you give us a little bit of the numbers, or again, refresh our memory?
We had about 100 swans wintering down in the area between Carnation and Falls City, approximately. And we discovered a couple of dead birds on Lake Langlois. And I just went, ooh, avian influenza. That was my first thought, but it wasn't. We took them in, x-rayed them, clearly lead in their system. And within 2 days, we were picking up. We had 26 birds one day, 11 alive, and those were euthanized. We just can't save the birds by the time we get them. And by the time we were done, we had 50, at least 50, that we could find, whether they were feather piles or whether they were, you know, whole birds. We did sample all of the birds' gizzards. We took them in and had the gizzards x-rayed. It's easier than transporting dozens of dead birds. and all of them have metal in their gizzard, and they all had classic signs of lead poisoning. So we know we lost 50 out of that 180 birds, and that's a substantial number. And right now the swans are moving around in different ways because of the drought that happened this last summer, and we're seeing a flood that happened in this zone at the same time in September, October, and now we're going to have another flood. So our volunteers are out 2 days a week, and I have to say that the department got these volunteers through the department, through volunteering for the agency, and they passed them on to me, and they are still working with us, a little bit with the agency too, but with us, and it's just been a great relationship. So we're monitoring to see what happens, because right now we've got a couple of hundred birds down in this zone again, and it's really early for this, so we don't know what's going to happen, and we're just really concerned. And hopefully, if we monitor enough, then it takes about, between ingestion of lead shot and death, is between 14 and 21 days. So if we're out there monitoring and we know where they're feeding, and if we do have a die-off now, this year, we're going to be able to backtrack and have a much better sense of where we really need to look. But we have a feeling where this is kind of zone is.
Thank you.
Thank you, Martha. Gordon Rue, please. And Ken.
Good morning, Chairman Smith and members of the Commission. I'm Ken Miller, a small forest landowner with two small tracts of timberland, one of which has severe and prolonged bear damage. I'm here today to support the wildlife interactions rule changes and consolidations, and to give you an update on our progress on some long-standing bear issues plaguing a relatively few number of small forest landowners. We do believe the WAC consolidations and clarifications will help the department manage wildlife conflicts more effectively. The changes appear reasonable and appropriate, but I would deviate from my written text here a little bit and say, I do hope you will consider the comments from our sister groups that work out in the field, Bruce, the Farm Bureau. I don't understand all the issues, but from my viewpoint, if it's not broke, don't fix it. I do hope you will also notice a lot of these WACs that you're consolidating deal with appropriate compensation to folks who have significant financial losses, except small forest landowners. I would argue that there are fewer small forest landowners impacted. For those of us that are impacted, the financial losses are more catastrophic than others. We are already taking preventative measures required by these damage compensation WACs, yet we aren't eligible for crop damage compensation. If we were compensated for our losses, it would far exceed all others combined. We have every right and justification to go to the legislature for a similar program, but at least I would prefer having the kind of efficient, physical, and timely help that urban folks have with their bear conflicts or others have with deer, elk, and particularly wolf problems. Effective solutions rather than compensation. A group of small forest landowners did have another very good exchange, spirited sometimes, of ideas with Mick and Stephanie last week. Initially, I felt all my years of coming to the department and the commission for help seemed to be backfiring in unyielding committee processes. But I'm increasingly confident that many issues will be resolved and increased help is near. I also note Jim Murphy was on our committee, and he submitted a couple of comments, visiting with Mick a little bit, and overnight, I believe most of his concerns are misunderstandings or misreadings of the very complex WACs. It's pretty tough for a small landowner to kind of understand. Pretty wonky for us. I do expect to return to the commission prior to next spring's damage period with our thanks to the department for respecting and appreciating us as landowners for the critter habitat that we provide. With service comparable to others with wildlife issues and a partnership sufficient to blunt the need for a very expensive compensation program, we do look forward to continued work with WDFW in the true spirit of collaboration. Thanks for listening. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you for your dedication and commitment over the years. and patience too. Any comments from Commissioner? Yes, Commissioner.
Are you satisfied with the progress you're making?
If you'd asked me a week ago, I'd have said no. Today, I'm saying yes. It's a good dialogue, and it's unfair for us. We want all of our issues solved right now. We're not giving the department enough slack for all that they've been working on with this WAC changes. They got to get this WAC stuff out of the way before they can spend more of the time needed. But they are listening, and the conversations have been fruitful. So,
all right.
Go ahead.
We had a very spirited discussion this morning at our Wildlife Committee meeting on this. And there again, to both you and Tom, your guys' world's my world too. So I damn well understand what you guys' concerns are. And I went ahead and complimented Mick and Steph. I think from where we are at to where we are today is huge. And I think we're definitely headed in the right direction. And one thing that we were reassured is that this hopefully will be a work in progress, that we get started in the right direction. There's bound to be some things come up that we don't anticipate today, and hopefully that we'll implement this and then go ahead. And if we start having issues, and trust me, your issue has been posed to Mick and Steph more than once. And I mean, you have our ears. We'll try and do our best to address your problems. And there again, hopefully this is a work in progress. And if you have problems, come back to us and we'll see what we can do.
And I will say that on some smaller process kind of things, it was evident that there's some changes in the paradigm thinking a little bit that are very positive. So I continue to be hopeful, and I do see progress, and I fully expect to be back here and be very complimentary.
Commission, Deputy Director Storm. My name is Gordon Rue. I'm a resident of Camino Island. I'm here today to speak ahead of agenda item number 9, which is a briefing on the commercial smelt fishery in Puget Sound. So a couple of areas in particular I'd like to flag for you in advance of that discussion. And I'll kind of run through those quickly here. Not a lot of time for background information, but when the 60,000-pound commercial harvest limit for smelt was implemented 2 years ago, there were no catch area quotas put in place. The situation today is that 88% of the total commercial smelt harvest is coming off the beaches of North Camino. These beaches represent about 3% of the documented smelt spawning grounds. Overfishing has been a concern of Camino residents for years, and the current structure of the fishery has done little to reverse that situation. Since quick reporting of catch is now a requirement for all commercial landings, my question is, why not establish individual catch quotas to shift commercial efforts into other areas of Puget Sound besides just Area 24A and 24C, which basically is the North Camino area? There's roughly 30 catch areas designated in Puget Sound, and yet 88% of the catch is coming out of these areas. And it's actually, if you drill down and look at it, it's a very, very small area. Currently, the information on stock abundance is not available to the department. The forage fish management policy states if insufficient information exists or the condition of the resource is poor, a conservative approach will be taken. Allowing 88% of the commercial smelt harvest to come off less than 3% of the documented smelt spawning beaches is not conservative management. Please institute catch area quotas and bring the commercial harvest of smelt in line with the management of other marine resources. We have a second issue up there, particularly in North Camino Island, has to do with the disorderly nature of the fishery. There's two reasons the department can close a commercial fishery. One is for conservation reasons. The other is because it's disorderly. The lawlessness of the commercial fishermen who work the North Camino shoreline certainly qualifies this fishery to be disorderly, or designated disorderly. The commercials have a complete disregard for private property rights and regularly trespass on private beaches. They verbally harass and intimidate area residents, dump garbage on the beach, and race up and down the shoreline after dark in boats with no running lights. Trespassing reports have been filed with the Island County Sheriff, and one fed-up 80-plus-year-old woman in the last year took two different commercial fishermen to court and won judgments against them each for trespass and littering. The Island County Parks Department has banned commercial use of the county's boat ramps in an effort to reduce conflicts between the commercial smelters and the boating public. Oftentimes, there's just one sheriff to cover the entire 40 square miles of Camano Island, so repeated calls of North Camano property owners and boaters to intervene in conflicts with the commercial smelters go unanswered. Perhaps it's time to close catch areas 24A and 24C to the commercial harvest of smelt, as the behavior of the commercials has only deteriorated over the last decade or so. Thank you.
Chair, I'm very familiar with that fishery, having grown up on Camano Island. I do think we need to revisit it. I don't have a crystal ball on what the best way is to do that, but I get a multitude of contacts from the public about problems with that. And when we have that much volume of upset residents, I think we need to look into it and figure out what's going on, and in particular based on the harvest rate in that particular area. So from my perspective, we're going to revisit that sooner than later.
I appreciate that. I mean, I think the situation's been bad for years, and it's deteriorated over the last 2 years because I think the commercials are frustrated. They've seen the catch quota reduced, and they're taking it out on the residents. And it's not safe. It's not orderly. And it's obviously, in the way it's being harvested, it's not doing anything for the resource.
Hi, my name is Robert Rayo. I live in Elma. We'd like to have been able to put public input on Grace Harbor, but we're not going to be able to attend the afternoon session due to prior commitments. I'll try to confine my comments to other areas. There's a serious problem in our coho returns this year, as everyone knows. There is also an ongoing problem that I've seen occur for the last 10 to 20 years in the ocean fisheries off our coast for salmon. Every year in August, we're not meeting quotas for recreational catch in the ocean, to where people aren't catching anywhere near the number of kings that were projected to be caught. And as a result, our state agency has taken the weird tack of saying, well, we'll up the quota to two kings so that that quota can be met. If the quota is not being the projected quota is not being met, I think that that's a really strong indication, as been borne out just about every year that this has been done, is that the runs are not late, they're depleted. The intercept rates going on in Canada and Alaska are driving over 50% of our returning terminal stocks out before they even get to us. And then we have the nerve, our state has the nerve, to allow people to keep two fish at that point when all projections show that the run is not going to make the expected size. We have not been making escapement levels in Grace Harbor for I don't know how many years now. We have not met 3 out of 5 years in years. And we need to do that. And to continually allow the commercial charter fleet, which is what it is, it's a commercial enterprise taking out recreational people, to completely rape that resource before it reaches the terminal fishery is an insane policy. And this has been going on because the last head of this commission was the president of the Westport Charter Boat Association. And all of his decisions were skewed towards making that fishery maximum sustainable yield. And as a result of that, the already depleted stocks that were intercepted in Alaska and Canada are further reduced before they get in there, leaving the Quinault and the recreational people to fight each other tooth and nail for scraps left over. And this year, the failure of our agency to provide realistic in-season management, which they had the numbers to do, was insulting to us all and forces people at each other's throats in a community already hard-pressed economically. And to deprive people of a food source because you're going to allow commercial people to go in and take more than their share is insane. Throughout our state, as co-managers, we have failed our recreational anglers because we allow the tribes in numerous fisheries to keep 70% to 80% of the supposedly 50% that they're allowed. Now, how does that work? Thank you for your time.
I think you got a couple of fisheries here kind of intermingled a little bit. You're talking about the ocean fishery.
Yeah.
The ocean fishery, I think it's fair to say, primarily targets Columbia River fish, which have had record runs for the last 3 years.
They're mixed stocks. There's no way of telling which ones are the Columbia River.
The upriver bright runs into Columbia have had records for at least two, if not the three years in a row. Are you more concerned about the ocean fishery or what actually happens in Grays Harbor? I'm just trying to get a grasp.
Well, all of our fisheries are over mixed stocks in the ocean. You can't tell what fish are bound for the Columbia and what fish are going to head into Grays Harbor. And, yeah, I am concerned about Grays Harbor stocks, but I'm also concerned about all the other stocks that are occurring. If you fish north of La Push and all those areas over mixed stocks, you're taking Grays Harbor stocks, you're taking Columbia River stock, you're taking Ho River stocks, you're taking stocks on rivers that are already depleted, that we already have problems on. The Ho has an incredible wild Chinook problem right now. The Chehalis and all those rivers have incredible wild Chinook problems. And to say that, well, we're having record runs on the Columbia and you're going to throw all the other rivers in the dustbin as a result of that. You're fishing mixed stocks in the ocean. There's no way to tell what's a Columbia River fish. And
well,
what's a Grays Harbor fish, or what's a Ho River fish, or what's a La Push fish. That's the
there are ways.
All the stocks
there are ways. Some of these are hatchery fish. Some of them have coated wire tags. The department has the ability to drill down on what the stocks are. But do we have a bigger problem in the future, just so you're aware? And that's part of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And that's Alaska coming after a whole bunch more of our Columbia River stocks. So we've got a much bigger issue on our screen to deal with over the next year and a half, just so you're aware of that.
Well, I am aware of it, and one of the things I would have pointed out is that the North of Falcone process has been a failure as far as the recreational anglers are concerned in protecting stocks in Washington State from those intercepts. We don't seem to have any leverage that we can use against Alaska and Canada, and they don't really seem to give any kind of concern to our needs. They're already have problems with their own stocks. They're not capable of managing their stocks, much less ours.
It's a lot more complexer than you make it. But I'll just ask this: when was the last time you were at a North of Falcon meeting?
I did not attend any because I spent 40 to 80 hours last year doing Grays Harbor management plan meetings. I was not able to attend those meetings, but I know other people that have, and they all consider that process broken.
Okay. Thank you. Any other? Thank you. Tom Davis, please, and we'll be the last, and Melanie.
Hi, my name is Melanie Rabalia. Good morning, everyone. I am from Elma, Washington. I've lived there for 15 years. I've lived in the state of Washington for 36 years, and I fish. When your first agenda came out, it was implied that there was no Grays Harbor time, so we made our plans to come around this. So I will try to talk once again, like Bob did, about the state of the salmon, but I will emphasize more on Grays Harbor. One of the issues that I'd like to talk about with the state of the salmon this year is the collapse of the 2015 coho returns. I accept that it was caused by a lot of things. There was an ocean blob that killed a lot of fish. Alaska, Canada intercepts. In addition to the actual other things that intercept, like the sea lions and the seals, it's noted it makes a great deal of difference. But when it was apparent that there was a problem going on in Grays Harbor County, the changes were made very slowly. I personally believe that it was about a week to 2 weeks late in making a decision. In-season management did happen. It happened in the whole state of Washington. Some places due to warm temperatures in the rivers. But that wasn't because of a lack of fish. That was because they knew that the fish was dying off. In Grays Harbor County, the numbers were coming in that things weren't right. This was a system failure. The attitudes of the harvest at all cost must change. We went through this a couple of last year before, that we need to make changes. It somewhat worked. The kings looked great. The kings were coming back. Every king I released, I was delighted to do so. It was happy times for me. Maybe we're going to meet escapement. People said to me, this is sad, we're releasing fish. I'm like, I'd rather have loved than lost than never loved at all. It was better catching a fish and releasing it and go, baby, go. Maybe we're going to meet escapement. But what happened with the silvers is atrocious. Once again, the attitude of harvest at all costs must change. Region 6 and the Quinault must manage these things better. I know that we cannot control the tribe, but the first step, and maybe we can then force them by making better steps and making better choices. And if we do the right thing and we step up to the plate, maybe they will too. Maybe we'll force their hand because they'll see that we're being better stewards of Mother Earth than they are. Maybe it'll just be guilt. I don't know, but something has to be done. Region 6 and the Quinault tribe aren't seeming to work together, whether they got the numbers. Some people say they do. Some people say they didn't. I don't know who to believe anymore. Transparency isn't there like we were hoping for. I was delighted that the lack of or the less amount of nets in the river helped. I think it helped with the fish. But ultimately, we can do a better job. The task force recommendations are being ignored presently. And last but not least, the Department of Ecology is looking at adding oil trains up and down the river. If you guys could say something about that being negative, that would be really good, because we're fighting for the fish, and when we dump a whole bunch of oil, it's not going to do any good. Thank you. Questions? Thank you. It's nice all to see you, especially you, Miranda.
Members of the commission, Deputy Director Storr, good to see you. I'm Tom Davis. I serve as the Government Relations Director for the Washington Farm Bureau. And I guess as I start out, I really, as I think you've heard from several folks already, want to thank the staff, Mick Cope and Stephanie Simic, for the work that they have done in reaching out to stakeholders as they've been developing the changes to bring to you for the wildlife interaction regulations. It's been a good process, and I would like to actually name Nate Pamplin as well, providing he's a guy that you can call and he answers his phone and he answers questions, and that's as a public person, that's always nice to have somebody in an agency you can reach out and talk to. So we brought many concerns to them, questions over the months, and I have to say all but one of our concerns have been addressed. So from our perspective, we think this has been a good process. And it's that one last remaining item that I want to bring to your attention, and we sent you a letter a couple of days ago, so you might have that before you. But that the issue left on the table for us is when a farmer experiences damage and decides the damage has reached a high enough level that it's worth going through the paperwork process to file a claim, when the adjuster comes out to do the assessment on the claim, the size of the damage, in the regulations now, it would put that cost-share language back in. And up to $600 a farmer would have to pay towards the cost of the adjuster fees for the damage that they incurred. And for our members and talking to the tree fruit industry and the wheat industry as well, we see that as an insult to injury. Nobody wants damage, and when you file a claim, we don't feel that we should have to bear the cost of the adjuster coming out to make the assessment to pay the claim. So that I just bring that before you for consideration. Some things to think about is prior to 2010, the agency paid the full cost of the adjuster fees. I had to go back and talk to some folks in the enforcement program to make sure that my memory served me correctly. For some of the new commissioners, I had the opportunity to actually work for this fine department from 2003 to 2010. And so that was my memory, that the department paid for it at that time. It didn't seem to be a burden to the program to do that. And in talking with staff, the legislature appropriates through statute, as you know, $120,000 a year for the payment of damage claims. And in the last 3 years, you haven't exceeded 75% of that amount of money in damage claim payments to farmers. So it's not a fiscal issue to ask farmers to pay for that amount. If it's an issue of trying to hold down frivolous claims, there have only been, last year, there were only 13 claims filed or submitted or requested. So it doesn't seem like, at least at this point, the information that I have, that the data substantiates the need to push that cost share requirement onto the farmers. And in the end, too, it does send a message to the farmers that are experiencing damage, and I think that's a bad message. So to maintain that good working relationship with the farmers out there, I request that you consider an amendment to remove that cost share language. Okay? Thank you.
I'm not real familiar with the history of this, but it almost sounds like any of us in business or personally when we have an insurance policy for anything, we have a deductible to probably try and defer claims that are put forward that I hate to call them frivolous, but may be deemed frivolous. Your thoughts on that?
So, again, I think, does the data bear that out? And I don't have all of that data before me. All I have is what was, you know, last year there were 13 claims filed. And going back historically, and again, relying on memory for what was going on in the 2000s, I don't recall that frivolous claims were a problem. And I think part of that problem is you've already got, in a sense, a screen on the front end. So for a farmer to actually apply for a damage claim, it takes a fair amount of work. And I used to hear the grumbling from the farmers that, you know, they didn't want to go through all of that paperwork. They'd rather just, you know, eat the damage rather than have to submit a claim. So I think on the front end, maybe that may be enough to limit the frivolous claims.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.